Welcome to Hello Universe, a podcast about spirituality in our everyday lives. We're your co-hosts, Kylie and Eva.
Welcome back, everybody. Welcome to another episode.
Hello, hello, friends. We're excited to be here.
Yeah, this is just turning into one of my most favorite activities of the week.
Yes. And that makes me very lucky because you are one busy bish.
Okay. Thank you for that lead in because actually when I was thinking about sort of what to share at the top of the show, that's kind of one of the big things I've been thinking about lately.
I have to interject. So in case you guys don't know, Kylie is honestly just, I don't know, she's like has 20 hands or 20 arms or something because she just does so much. She's actually traveling where are you going again?
Springfield, Missouri and Maryland.
You have a plane later today to go to these places for work, and you are still able to jump on in the morning to record this podcast with me. So I'm very appreciative.
Well, and that's the thing. So, you know, I have a busy 9-to-5 job. I have 2 small children. We have this beautiful podcast, and I am growing my business, reading Akashic Records for clients. And I just had this realization recently that, you know, if I don't prioritize these projects like the podcast, and which honestly is not hard to prioritize because it's so much fun. But if I don't prioritize trying to grow my own business and I always leave it to the last thing on the to-do list, it's not going to grow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That, you know, if I think of all the different things that are important to me, it's like such a cliche mom thing, but I just have been consistently putting myself at the very bottom of the list. And then I've been resentful of all the other things mm-hmm. on the list. Mm-hmm. I still don't know exactly what it looks like, but I'm really committing to myself to show up on social media, show up for my mailing list, show up for redoing my website, all these things, because show up for the, you know, I'm creating this workshop on developing your intuition mm-hmm. and sort of digging in deeper to connect with your intuition. And I've had it 90% done for like a month and a half.
Yeah.
Right. Like just,
and I've seen it and it's so beautiful. And I think it can be super helpful to a lot of people. And you know, right now it's like the longer you wait, the longer people who need this information aren't getting, you know, the support that they could be getting.
Yeah. And like the energy that I am putting into it now is it's like, it's so much fun. It's so beautiful, but I'm acting like it needs to be perfect. Right. Mm-hmm. And it, like you said, it needs to be in people's hands more than it needs to be sitting on my Canva dashboard. Yeah.
But what's crazy is also, it is like, it's beautiful. It's already so well done, but you know how it is. Like we never give ourselves enough credit. Like we're always going to find something wrong with it, but it's already, I've seen it and it's beautiful.
Well, and this is what's interesting too, is there is like one recorded guided meditation that I want to do. I recorded a draft, so I want to kind of record a real version. And there's like 2 paragraphs to write. And that's been what's on the to-do list for 6 weeks.
Yeah.
Right. Like mm-hmm. that is maybe an hour's worth of work. Like I am busy, but I have an hour.
Yeah.
I just got the screen report from how much time I spend on my phone. I have an hour.
Yeah. So yeah. And maybe Kylie, you could tell the audience a little bit about where this is stemming from. Right. Cause I remember you did an Instagram video about, what was the topic that I thought it was so good?
Oh yeah. Actually. So Jesse DeSilva is going to be a future guest on this podcast.
Woo-hoo!
And I was listening, I was watching a Facebook Live that she did, and she talked about like how she just hit this point of being like, I'm just sick of my own bullshit and I'm just going to show up. It's not going to be perfect, but I'm just going to go all in. And the thing that's really cool is like the girl is on fire. Mm-hmm. Like her energy has been so magnetic and I was so drawn to everything that she was posting. And then she shared this, that like this was her energy, that she was like, I'm just going to lean all in. And I was so drawn to that. And yeah. So I sort of am trying to do my own version of that.
I'm not putting up with our own bullshit, which I think we can all relate to. It's like, you know, the saying, it really is like, well, I have actually this post-it note up on my wall that says, get out of the way, meaning I'm the only one who's in my own way most of the time. When I go back to that reminder, it actually really is helpful. What it means is like, I can make it less complicated. I don't have to overthink it so much. I don't have to, it doesn't have to be perfect. Like, it's actually gonna be okay. I'm the only person who's, you know, making it more difficult than it has to be.
Yeah. And like, and I think if there's something, like for me with this workshop, for example, you know, why is it that, like, be curious. So instead of responding to ourselves with judgment, be curious. There's some reason that I have not yet prioritized this 1 hour to finalize it. And I could beat myself up about it, but that is not productive either. Mm-hmm. But I do think there's a way we can meet ourselves with curiosity. Like, what need am I trying to meet by holding this back in? Why is there a part of me that thinks it is safer to stay small? Mm-hmm. And what does she need so that I can show up as my, like, biggest, boldest, authentic self? And that biggest, boldest, authentic self might also be wearing sweatpants, right? Like, it's not about being perfect.
Right. I think that's so beautiful. Yeah. That's like the work that we're all trying to do. We essentially all have this scared little kid inside of us kicking and screaming, and she's afraid of being seen. She's afraid of, like, getting it wrong and being criticized. And we just got to love up on her as much as, like, that's so much of the work. We have to give ourselves the love that I think we didn't necessarily get as kids or whatever it is. And we kind of have to, we have the opportunity now, I think, to step up to the plate and be, like, so freaking loving and warm and kind and compassionate. And I do think it works.
I think so. And I think what's interesting is that love is not one flavor, right? Love means many different things. And, like, so my son is learning, has been in swim lessons. And have I talked about his swim lessons on the podcast?
No, I don't think so.
Oh my God. I could just do a whole episode about his swim lessons, because it is this real time, like, navigating fear with your kid and learning how to, like, love your kid and speak a language to each other. And anyway, but it's been really interesting because sometimes loving him through swim class is like, I know you don't want to go underwater, but right now I'm dunking you underwater.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes loving him through swim class is like giving him a big hug and saying, okay, you can float on your back now. Like, you don't have to, because he loves that part.
Yeah.
Like, so you don't have to go underwater right now. Yeah. And loving him is always celebrating afterwards. Whatever you just did in that pool is amazing. Even if you screamed and cried the entire time,
yeah,
you were there in that pool and it was worthwhile and it was amazing. And that's, and I don't mean to say, and there's a way right now, if you caught me, I was trying to diminish my own parenting. I'm not going to do that. But I just think that that is the work, is figuring out, what does it mean to love ourselves?
You know? I just had this, like, really interesting visual and analogy pop into my head that I think is actually very relevant and true, which is that the reason that you're able to sort of guide your son through these swimming lessons is because ultimately he's safe. Like, he might be freaked out, but, like, in reality, he's completely safe. You know, like, nothing, you're never going to let anything happen to him. Right. And that's why you can dunk him into the pool, even if he's, like, screaming his head off. And I feel like that's an analogy for the universe, which is, the universe is essentially our parent being like, hey, Kylie, you got to do this thing, and you're kicking and screaming and you hate it and it feels unsafe. That's why we don't want to do it, because we're scared. It's so scary to put ourselves out there, right?
But
we don't see what our parent, quote unquote, our parent knows, which is, like, the universe or whatever, being like, you're safe, girl. I got you.
And I think this is where the curiosity piece is so important, is getting curious about why we feel unsafe. Because, for example, with my son, for the longest time, I thought that he felt unsafe because he didn't like the water in his face. He didn't like the water in his nose. Mm-hmm. And so I was constantly trying to coach him around the water, being like, blow your nose, blow bubbles when you go under, this or that. Turns out he was afraid because he couldn't see me underwater. And so he was afraid that he didn't know how to find me. So we just bought him goggles. Right? Like, the second I knew that, it was such an easy solution. But it took finding out what the real problem was. So with ourselves, like, if we're just kind of like waterboard, like we're just like being mean to ourselves again and again, that's not helpful. But if we're really curious, we're like, why are you scared? What do you need?
Right, right. If you're curious, yeah. if you actually, then you can find the answer and actually address it essentially.
Right.
But
right.
that takes, I think, yeah. I mean, this it takes stillness. I think it takes like a willingness to search and experience and feel the thing that we're scared of.
And I think trying to show up for with as much non-judgment towards ourselves as possible.
Yeah.
Which is something that I think our guest today yes. does really well.
Yes. A perfect segue into introducing Anna Franzosa, who we're going to introduce her in the podcast, but I know that we recorded this podcast a couple months ago now, but honestly, it's one of the conversations that has stuck with me because Anna is someone who struggles with chronic illness and she speaks about it really beautifully and eloquently. And it's resonated with me personally because I have chronic fatigue and it's something that I've had for years and years and I still don't know what it is and it comes and goes. So sometimes it's like really, really bad and then sometimes I'm totally fine. But I've never consider myself someone with chronic illness because I'm still pretty high functioning for the most part. But really I learned a lot from this podcast about what it means to be self-compassionate and to be really kind with yourself and to, yeah, not judge yourself so much through these things. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, there's a lot of wisdom. And I've also thought of this conversation often. This is a good nourishing. This is a good one.
Yeah. And I also think Anna is someone who doesn't also put up with a lot of bullshit.
Yeah, that's true.
Which is also really nice. Yeah.
I love how often the things that we talk about at the top of the show end up like perfectly thematically on point.
Connecting. Yeah.
That's great.
All right. So we hope you guys enjoy this podcast. I know I did. And now it's time for Anna. And now a quick word from our sponsor,
which is us. So we are doing a giveaway to celebrate the launch of Hello Universe. And we just want to make sure everyone knows all about it.
Yes. So in order to apply for the contest, we're actually giving out two separate prizes. The first one is what I call the mega package because it's including a ton of stuff, a 90-minute one-on-one coaching session with me, Eva, and also a 60-minute Akashic Record reading with Kylie, and then three of our favorite books. So all of that is in this mega prize package number one. And in order to apply, I'm going to throw this to Kylie.
Yeah. So, go onto iTunes or Apple Podcasts and rate and review the show. It makes a huge, huge difference in trying to get the show in front of new audiences. So many of you have already left such beautiful reviews that literally have like made me tear up. But we don't know what your like handle is on iTunes, right? So we can't, like Yogi Swan wrote us a beautiful review, but I don't know who that is. So if you are Yogi Swan and you want to screenshot your review and then email us at podcast@hellouniversepod.com,
yep.
That's your entry.
Yep.
Because that way when you win, we know how to get in touch with you.
Yeah. So make sure that you send us that photo because I think we've been talking about it on our Instagram. And so that's something that maybe I didn't make super clear, but that's how we know that you have entered. And we'll announce the winners on March Friday, the 13th.
And then as if that wasn't enough, we're doing another giveaway because totally transparently, we couldn't decide what to give away. So we were like, well, let's just give it all away.
Yeah, because we wanted to give away so much stuff, especially because Kylie and I are both book nerds. So there's just like a lot of really wonderful books in this contest.
Yes. So we are giving away two new books, one by Young Pueblo and one that's called You Already Know by Helen Jacobs, which is all about connecting to your intuition, and a deck of oracle cards from one of my most favorite artists, Rebecca Campbell. And all of that comes from sharing the news about Hello Universe. So if you want to go on Instagram, mm-hmm. So this one to Eva.
So you can go on to one of our Instagram accounts and look for a podcast post in which in that post, you just have to tag a friend who you think would really like the podcast or maybe even some of the prizes we're giving away. So the idea is that you can help spread the word. And for every single friend that you tag, that counts as one entry to win this second bundle of stuff. So if you tag three friends, then that's three entries.
And if all of this sounds like a lot, TLDR is go onto iTunes or Apple Podcasts and say how great our show is, pretty please. Tell us you did that so we can give you things. And then go onto Instagram and tell your friends how awesome we are. And then we will also give you things.
Yes, that's pretty much it. And honestly, we've gotten some great reviews, but not that many people have entered to win yet. So you, as of now, everyone has like a really, really good shot.
Yeah. So go do that. After you listen or multitask, listen to this interview. And if you're not driving also.
Yeah, write us a review. So subscribing, rating, and reviewing is how you can be considered to win.
All right.
Thanks so much. Bye.
We are so excited to introduce our guest today. I've known this guest for a while now. Anna and I took yoga teacher training together, and she is just a delightful human being. Anna Franzosa is an artist, a yoga teacher, an animal rescuer, and a vulnerable and outspoken advocate on chronic illness and chronic pain, and just a delight of a human. So I'm so happy to have you here.
Yay, thank welcome, you. Anna.
Thank you so much, and thank you for all your nice words. I like them all.
So one of the questions we like to start with is a broad question, but I'm, you know, so take it wherever you'd like, but you know, spirituality is this huge thing, and it can mean so many different things to so many different people. And in fact, I think the very point of it is that it is personal. So I'm curious if you could just speak to a little bit about what spirituality means for you.
Yes, let's dig deep right away.
Yeah, deep end right away.
We don't mess around.
Cannonball.
I've got my floaties on. I'm ready to go. So what does spirituality mean to me? Gosh, that's such a tough question to answer. So I understand why you have to have a whole podcast devoted to it. You know, it used to be that spirituality to me very much meant church, hymns, books, you know, that were written by people that died very long time ago. You know, I was raised in a Catholic family. I'm basically half Irish and half Italian. So we liked our Catholicism. And we had a lot of conversations in my family about spirituality because I was diagnosed with a condition called complex regional pain syndrome when I was 8 years old. I started having symptoms when I was six. The short, you know, word for it is CRPS. It also used to be called reflex sympathetic dystrophy, or RSD. So it's nice to have lots of acronyms.
All the letters. You're like an alphabet soup.
It's true. My doctor used to call me atypical Anna because I have atypical everything.
Oh, wow.
I know, but I digress. So because of that, I think that a lot of people in my family, not just my little nuclear family, but in the extended family, there were lots of crises of faith that happened. You know, my father was very active in the Catholic Church. He would like read at mass, and he's been part of choir and things like that. And my mom was very active when I was young, but then like she taught CCD and things like that. And then she kind of took a step back. And I don't want to make this about their journey, but they were always very open with me about how their feelings surrounding spirituality shifted a lot as they went through difficult times. So even though I was raised in a very Catholic household, by the time I became an adult, I'd had so many conversations about what spirituality means within my family that I felt pretty confident in my ability to come up with my own kind of definitions. And for me now, I would say that spirituality is all about our connections to each other and our connections with nature. I would say the times when I feel the most connected with other people are honestly when I'm at a concert and I hear thousands of people singing along. Like, that is a really spiritual moment for me.
Yes, I love that.
You know,
that,
oh, well.
I love the way we, I'm sorry to interrupt because I want you to continue, but
the way we find,
like you started off by saying you used to think spirituality was books and hymns, and that there are all these moments that we may be so quick to dismiss or overlook or, you know, maybe aren't spiritual to someone else, but like, yeah, as a concert, as spiritual, that's just fucking beautiful.
Yeah, I had someone say to me once, or I had somebody ask me once, I don't remember where the conversation was, but they asked me, what does church mean? And I said, well, church is the place where the people gather, because that was what I was taught. And he said, no, what does church mean? What is church to you? Where do you feel like you're in church? And I was kind of like, I don't go to church. But then I thought about it, and suddenly it occurred to me, basically my church is at the Xfinity Center in Mansfield, Massachusetts, where I listen to concerts. I was like, I've never felt more, if church is a communion of people gathering in worship of something that moves you to positive action and to bringing positive energy into the world, live music does that for me, especially when I hear 1,000 people, 10,000 people singing along. There's something about it.
Oh, I am so on the same page as you, sister. Like,
I love it, Eva.
I've often thought that I think sometimes spirituality is also a feeling, you know, and like, that's such a, that feeling of when, I don't know, you're people who you oftentimes, you know, strangers, absolute strangers, you don't know these people at all, but then there's like this collective connectedness, experience. And everyone's just like elevated on this new high. And I also think that music, so it's like a people gathering, which causes like a sort of feeling, but also the music too. I think music is so intrinsic to so much of our experience in the world. Like, you know, music has been around for forever, and I think has been considered a spiritual thing in cultures, you know, throughout time. So
yeah, and I've also always kind of wondered if it's an empath thing to be in a giant place with a bunch of people who are experiencing something and to have it be almost a religious experience. And I'm so interested in whether other people here experience it in the same way that I do. So it's fascinating that you do, Eva. Thank you for sharing that.
So maybe this is just me, but I always thought that everybody was having that experience. I know that sounds arrogant, but I'm like, everybody must be feeling the same way that I'm feeling, which I guess that's just like, I guess in those moments, I feel so excited and so much like...
It's a universal experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so different experience over here.
Love it. Go on.
Music is never like my first go-to form of art. My husband is a huge musician, and I joke that my son, who's 2.5, taught me how to sing, because I used to like literally like didn't make it into 8th grade chorus. Although this is an aside, but I didn't realize I wasn't making it in. And so I just showed up on the first day and told him he made a mistake.
Oh my gosh. That's amazing.
He was too like dumbstruck to say anything. So I stayed in chorus and only years later realized what happened.
Oh my gosh. That's amazing.
Yeah. And despite like my like stowaway version of chorus for many years, I could not carry a tune at all. Oh man, this is such a tangent. My son is like loves music. And actually, when I was pregnant with him, I had this dream where it was all rainbows. And my son came to me and was like, I want to show you where I am. And it was just like rainbows and music and rainbows and music.
Aww.
And I really believe that it was my son coming to me.
Oh my gosh, and knowing him, I believe it.
Right? Because he is rainbow. Like, he is like loves like colors and rainbows, and like insisted on getting a pair of sparkly pink shoes for sneakers recently. Anyway, this is so far afield of where we started, but all of this is to say I now can carry a tune. I think because he was like, Mom, I'm a musician, so like, get your shit together. But for forever, when I would go to concerts, you know, I like language and I like pictures. Mm-hmm. And so concerts made me feel really uncomfortable because it was just music, and music is like, I have to really pay attention. I have to, I have to really make an effort to get lost in music. Whereas mm-hmm. I know it sounds like for both of you, for my husband, like it just is what happens as soon as live music starts. And so concerts were like, were for a long time the place where I was just aware of how much my brain did never, like never shut up. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't particularly enjoy them because I was like, oh, brain, why don't you stop?
Yes. Oh my right. gosh, Kylie, your experience, you're describing, I think, my partner exactly. I think he would probably really agree with you. And I think, and I also know that for many people, concerts are actually very anxiety inducing because they're so intense and crowded and you're hot. And what if you get, what if you're claustrophobic? You know, it's mm-hmm. it's a nightmare. But I think what's so interesting about this is that, yeah, going back to, I think what we were originally saying, which is that it's a spiritual experience is different for everybody. And
right.
I just love your answer so much, Anna, because
absolutely.
I also think it's something to think about, like that, it's personal. And also, you know, since I know you, I would have expected you to say something about like in Shavasana or like when I'm with my animals or like, it's interesting how you can know someone and like, we've had conversations about this yeah. and still not know what someone's personal experience with the spirituality is, which is just like such an important reminder to just stay open.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Anyway.
How else does spirituality show up in your life? Because I feel like that's one way. And I imagine just given all the different, you know, you have your hand in so many different things. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. I'm just going to talk and it'll either make a lot of sense or it won't. So it might turn into just this
perfect
babbling mess, but we'll see. So there's something that I say at the beginning of all of my yoga classes where I tell folks that much of my practice and my teaching is defined by the first principle of yoga, which is ahimsa, which basically means nonviolence. I know Kylie knows this. I'm not sure how into yoga you are, Eva.
I do love yoga, but I don't know. Honestly, a lot of the language is beyond me. So I would love all the explanation that you want to give.
So I'm by no means an expert on Sanskrit or even on yoga. I mean, who really is? But as I mentioned, I always talk about ahimsa in the beginning of class. It's an idea that basically means nonviolence. And I think it's very simple for us to take nonviolence at face value and be like, I won't hurt people. You can take it further. I won't hurt animals. I won't hurt things. You know, you can take it as deep as you want. But I feel like as human beings, we generally project everything outwards. And especially for this principle of yoga, I think it's imperative that you project it inwards. So nonviolence against the self. For me, being somebody who's lived my life with, you know, severe intractable pain, pain that doesn't go away, I spent a lot of time like not being very nice to myself. And the way that this connects to spirituality is that I think I've had a lot of people tell me that I should pray about my pain, that they're praying for me, and they're doing all of those things for me to try to heal me and so on and so forth. And kind of over the course of my life, but especially probably in the last year and a half or so, once I learned about this concept of ahimsa, I started thinking about the kinds of ways that I speak to myself and how I wouldn't speak to other people the way that I speak to myself. Mm-hmm. You know, telling myself that I'm not worthy of things. That I'm not good enough for things. You know, for a long time, I liked the idea of being a yoga teacher, but I thought, who would want to see a disabled yoga teacher? And then at one point I said, oh, good Lord, me.
Oh, wow.
I would like to see a disabled yoga teacher. I have it in my mind that I'm not good enough because I'm not doing backflips and all these things. I have nothing to bring to the table as a yoga instructor or as a yogi, that I am somehow less than or somehow other. And I slowly kind of started to realize that that's bullshit. Can I say bullshit?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I already did.
Okay. I actually summarized this podcast to someone recently that I was like, you know, it's about like love and swearing.
Oh, that I am fucking perfect. So I just kind of started having this, my own journey of the self, where I was thinking a lot about how I talk to myself and how we talk about each other. And, you know, and that's kind of what brought me into yoga teaching, was saying, you know, it would be so great to see somebody who isn't perfectly able-bodied teaching yoga, you know, because you don't have to know how to do everything to teach everything. You don't have to be physically capable of doing everything to teach anything. You know, I have knowledge to impart and I like to share. And going through the yoga teacher training, Kylie and I were very blessed to be with, honestly, one of the most incredible groups of women I've ever encountered. Just the depth that everyone was willing to go to share. It honestly changed how I viewed spirituality, because I never really understood So I would hear people talk about church as a community, and that spirituality is about communion between people. And I had never really experienced that in a large group until I went through yoga teacher training. And especially not with a group of women, which sounds kind of terrible, but it's true. In general, when there's been a large group of women, I've found myself on the outside for any variety of reasons that don't really matter here. But I found myself in communion with these absolutely brilliant and strong and kind women. And I started to realize that for me, spirituality is about sharing oneself with the universe and with others and accepting their gifts in return. Does that make sense?
Oh my God, that's so beautiful. It makes so much sense that I'm like, in some ways, it sounds like something that I intrinsically know to be true, but I don't know if I've actually ever heard anyone put it that way before.
Yeah. I love how you put so much of the lens through which you're viewing spirituality and talking about it here in this conversation is about relationship, and you keep talking about community and communing with people. And I just feel like that's something I'm going to walk away and really sit with and think about, because I think I really tend to process this as like I'm an island. And it's, I'm curious actually, if you could, I guess, speak more to, are there certain characteristics of relationships that make you feel like, yes, something spiritual is here? Or do you feel like relationships are fundamentally spiritual? Or do you want to answer this question in some different way that I haven't asked yet?
Honestly, when I think of people and everything, I don't know, maybe it's a little woo-woo. I know you like the woo-woo. But
like swearing, woo-woo is safe here.
Good. I just think that we're all spiritual. We're beings of spirit, not necessarily spiritual beings, but beings of spirit. I think that's why we can connect to animals and we can connect to trees. You know, I certainly don't know how to commune with a tree, but I definitely feel something magical when I sit on a limb of a tree and the wind blows and I hear the leaves rustle. I haven't done that in probably 20 years, but it's a thinking about it brings a feeling to me that is similar to when I feel connected to another person. And so I would say that spirituality as a communion between beings is something that's always available if both beings are open. That's kind of how I feel. You know, I feel that we're all connected. I can see in my life that small things that happen in totally different places around the world can slowly but surely ripple all the way around and make a big difference. I mean, just look at that young lady, the environmental activist whose name just flew out of my mind.
I'm forgetting her last name.
Thornburg? Yes. So just seeing how this, and she's not certainly not the first child to be an environmental warrior and to try to make a difference in the world, but to see how this one little voice could make such a ripple effect, it's amazing. And I don't know.
Yeah, but I think Kylie, I can understand what you mean when you say like sometimes spirituality, what did you say, something about being on an island? Because I think so much it's like I'm trying to do my internal work, and it's because I'm trying to feel a sense of ultimately peace. I just want to feel peaceful. But there's this whole other aspect of it that I remember. It's like when I'm in the rare moments, in the very rare moments where I feel really tuned in, and if I'm going to be very honest here, if I'm doing like mushrooms or psychedelics and my mind is just on another plane.
Yes.
Like
you've
what
moved
I
beyond us.
Well, what I remember in those moments is like I feel like I'm being brought back to a truth, which is that like, oh, we're all connected. Like, and we all know this, right? This is something that we say often, but to really feel that and remember that and be like, oh, we are actually all one, that there's no separation between you and me and, you know, me and the universe or me and God or, you know, whatever you want to call it. Part of me is like, my mind is doing flips because I'm like, yes, I don't talk about this piece enough, this piece about how spirituality is a tool for us to remember that we're all connected and how can we also connect realistically on an everyday level, you know, amidst conflict or tension or insecurities and all of those things.
And I think too, that connection is not like a nice quote, like it's real, right? Like when we're really tuned in, it is like a real, like, you know, you walk into a room and you can tell if someone's in a bad mood or not, even if you don't know them, right? Like, cause like we are like just, we are connected in a real, real way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there has to be something to the idea that people give off some kind of vibration or pheromone or something, because otherwise, you know, if somebody's just sitting there and looking and has just a gloomy face, you wouldn't be able to tell if it's just the way their face sits or something else.
Anna, do you consider yourself an empath? Because you mentioned that earlier.
I do.
Can you talk a little bit about that and what that means for you?
Oh, gosh. Being an empath, it's not something that I really knew was a thing until probably I was an adult. Like, I didn't really understand that that was something that wasn't a universal experience. Kind of like how you were saying, Eva, about concerts. You know, something that Kylie knows about me is that I have this very strange talent where if I know someone and they're pregnant, I know what they're having. Like,
true story.
And the thing is, I don't even know if it's really real, but so far it's been real. So I just keep going with it. But
also, sorry not to interrupt, but just to like back up your beautiful powers. When I was pregnant with my daughter, like you just had this beautiful way of saying like there was one point where I was like really wanted. I was like, okay, she's due in a month. Like she's gonna come early, and you were like, she's happy in there, like she's good. And you were right, she did not come early. And then there was another time that like you just walked up to me, we were like teaching a class together, and you just walked up to me and you whispered, you're like, she's just pure sunshine. And I mean, like, babies are sunshine, right? But like people like stop us to be like, she is pure sunshine, like that phrase people have used. So
anyway. Oh, I didn't know that, but I think about that often, in that, like, I distinctly remember that moment when we were up on the third floor, and I was just like, I was just looking at you, and I was just like, oh, that little magic bean you're growing. I just, oh, she radiated out of you. But yeah, so I feel like that's an empath thing for me.
Do you mean like being able to sense things?
Yeah. So like, I've been able, just in terms of weird pregnancy things, like there have been times where like I have a cousin, and when his wife was pregnant, I had spent a lot of time with her, and I spoke with her on a Friday, and she said, I don't know if I can go back to work on Monday. She said, I just don't know if I can do this anymore. I said, oh, you won't have to, you'll have the baby before Monday. And she's like, the baby's not coming. And I said, the baby will be here before Monday. And then lo and behold, she called me, I think it was Saturday, and she was like, so I have a baby now.
Yeah, that's so interesting. The reason I ask though is because I hear the word empath being used, and my understanding of it is mostly just that it's like there's different levels of it. And I think, yeah, I just wanted to hear you speak more about that as somebody who feels like they're an empath.
Yeah, and I mean, I feel like I'm very, very keyed in on people. And I will say that experience of feeling like I'm very keyed in on people's emotions can actually be kind of dangerous, in that my like default setting is to try and fix and save and help and those kinds of things. And that was definitely, I was married to somebody who was diagnosed as a malingering narcissist by the time we got divorced. He was not a very kind person. But it took me a very long time. We were together for like all of my 20s. And it took me a very long time to even begin to see that he was not very kind to other people, and then even longer to figure it out about me. But for me, being at the empath stuff all around that, it kind of turned into a codependency. Because he was a narcissist, so he needed attention, and I was an empath, and I knew he needed attention.
Right.
So it was just this constant negative feedback loop.
I do think that's the plight of the empath, right? Because it's like it comes with a little bit of the territory. So then part of the lesson is learning how to have boundaries and to listen to yourself and all that stuff.
Yes, absolutely. And I didn't really start to learn how to build boundaries safely for a long time. And I think a lot of that was learning the difference between building boundaries and building walls. Because I don't want to build walls. And for a long time, I conflated them as the same thing. So I would think, well, if I tell this person that I don't want them to talk to me that way, then I'm putting a brick in a wall that is between us. But I've learned that people who are safe, if you tell them that something isn't okay, you're not putting a brick in a wall. You're just coming to a mutual understanding and agreement that we're two people that are coming from different places. This is not acceptable to me. And if you're a kind person, you will honor that.
You're making me think of this interview I listened to with Brené Brown, who you and I are both like huge Brené Brown fans. And when we started talking about this, I wrote down as our like desired guest, our first person in our town was like Brené Brown.
We're like, when we're famous.
We'll know we've made it when, but you're making me think of this something that she talked about in this interview that I've really carried with me and has had a huge impact, which is that one of the studies that she did, around, sort of people who are the most empathetic, and the most, that was the term she used. They went back, you know, I don't know, for those of you who don't know Brené Brown, but she's a researcher a lot around shame, and she does this combination of like qualitative, quantitative research that's really cool. And so
she's really fascinating to listen to.
Great. We'll link you to her famous TED Talk if you haven't checked her out. You should watch it. And so she talks about how, you know, they pulled together all people who are most empathetic, and then they kind of went back to try to figure out like what's the commonality, because there were all walks of life, all different types of people, all different types of personas. And what it came down to is that the people who are able to be the most giving had the best boundaries.
That makes a lot of sense.
Right?
Well, and it's so, also wasn't also that the people who no, and also the people who were able to be the most giving. Oh no, the people who had the best boundaries were those who were most empathetic.
Yeah.
Wasn't that what it was? Like,
is that what I said or did I screw it up?
I think you said, I think it's both. I think both are right. I think you said that the people who were the most giving were had the best boundaries.
Yeah.
And I think
it's both are true.
Yeah.
Because like in order to be able to give and to give like freely, when you know where the line is, where you're not giving so much that you're empty, right? Mm-hmm. You're not giving so much that you sacrifice yourself. And when you know the clear relationship between like providing love to people and loving yourself and what that clear relationship is, it frees you to just keep on loving. But when you're unsure of what the boundaries are, that's when you have to do this like pull back, scarcity, weird balance that I think a lot of us can get trapped into. So yeah, that I love that what you just
said. Do you think that boundaries create an element of safety in a relationship?
Yeah.
I think so, yeah.
I think so too. When I think about the times where I've had to tell somebody who is very important to me that I couldn't allow them to speak to me in a certain way or bring up another topic in the same way, when they reply in a in agreement, I definitely came to feel more safe with that person. So maybe, I don't know if it's the boundary being respected that creates safety, or if you have safety, you can ask for a boundary.
Oh, I think, yeah, I think it's both. I think it's cyclical, right? But I think for, in my own experience, an area where I've had to put up a lot of boundaries with me and my mother, mm-hmm. also chronically ill. And I mean, I has a laundry list of different issues. And I think I definitely feel safer. Like, it's interesting. Like, I'm so much better at setting boundaries between her and I, which makes me feel more capable of showing up, because then I don't have this fear in my head of, well, when is this going to end? Like, right. if without the boundary, what my story becomes is, oh no, she's just going to keep taking or taking, or she's going to continue mm-hmm. to do this, or it's going to be never ending. And I'm scared to even dip my toe in. And so then I keep backtracking. But the minute I have a boundary, then I could be like, okay. And she knows my boundary. And she's also, I'm laughing because for the longest time I had the story in my head that she wasn't going to respect my boundaries. So I didn't even ask. And then I asked and she was like, okay. And I was like,
totally on board.
Yes. And I was like, oh my God, I'm an asshole. Like, I was just making these assumptions about my mother that she was going to take it all personally. And she was like, all right, cool. Like, you know, no problem.
One of those stories we tell ourselves, as Brené right. Brown says.
Yes. Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
And now that I have boundaries, it's like, okay, well then I can show up consistently and all the time, you know, like so much more fully, because I know it's not a never ending, like, black hole.
So setting that boundary and having her reply in agreement, that really made you feel more safe with your mom.
Oh, completely. Yeah. But it's also, like you said, part of that was because she respected it. Mm-hmm. So I think it's both. It's like, having a boundary is important. And then of course it needs to be respected by the other person, because I think it's a two-way street.
But I think too, I think sometimes what can be hard when like, as a people pleaser, is that when we ask for a boundary and then it's not respected, then we have to make a decision, right? Yeah. And so sometimes it's really scary to ask for that boundary, because, you know, if you had asked your mom for that boundary and she had taken it personally and it had blown up, then you would have had to make a decision. Like, well, do I kind of make myself smaller because that is the conditions of this relationship, or do I have to pull myself even further back from this relationship? And both of those are hard decisions to make. And so,
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I can say, I can't speak for Eva, obviously, but I've had to make, so I have a boundary. It's a very specific boundary, which is basically, if you accuse me of lying about being sick, if you talk shit about the fact that I'm sick, if you in any way make it sound like I am a liar and exaggerator, you basically get one chance. And I tell you, no. Mm-hmm. And if you don't respect it, we will never have a close relationship. I will always be perfectly nice to you. If I see you in public, I will wave. Mm-hmm. You know, I will be an event that you're at. I will go to a Thanksgiving dinner and sit across the table from you, and I will be super nice, but you will never know anything personal about me from my lips again. Mm. Because I know that I can't trust you with the thing about me that is the most difficult. Yeah. For myself to live with. And, you know, having CRPS is my whole life. I can't get away from it. I live with myself, and I live with my thoughts, and it's my longest relationship, and it will last until I die. Mm-hmm. And that's just a boundary that I had to learn how to set. And it has cost me, you know what? I don't even want to say it has cost me relationships. I would say it has freed me from people that weren't worthy of what I'm willing to give them.
Yes, I know.
That's
love that.
So beautiful. Oh my God. Yeah, that's beautiful. I'm goosebumps.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm not saying that is pleasant at all. Like, that's me sobbing in bed and my partner hugging me and telling me I am worthy, and, you know, this doesn't define who I am as a person and things like that. It is a very devastating thing to go through, but it's something that I've had to do it many times. And I've had people who pulled away from me, and then they would say things. And
yeah, I was gonna ask, does that happen often? I mean, not,
yeah,
it's not about the shit talking. I just want to know more about your experience and what
Yeah, it's a really terrible thing that happens when you have an invisible illness, especially when it's one that doesn't just deteriorate you constantly. You know, my first experience with it was when I was in fifth grade. And so let's see, I was about 10 years old. And I've always been open with talking about what's going on with me because, I mean, I'm actually a really shy person, believe it or not, but I've never had any problem if people ask me, why are you on crutches or whatever, to be like, I have a neurological condition. This is what's going on. Because I feel like the more visible you are and the more people know, the more understanding they should be, mm-hmm. in theory. Mm-hmm. So kids at school knew what was going on. Actually, no, the first really bad experience, there's so many of them. Isn't that terrible?
Yeah, it is.
So let's see. I'll give you a quick rundown. So third grade, I had my hand in a splint and I was riding my bike. And one of the kids saw me riding my bike down the street and then reported me to the other kids at school that I didn't have a problem with my hand because I was riding my bike. And I was like, what does my hand have to do with riding a bike? But it was a rumor that was spread all around third grade. And then in fourth grade, I had been on crutches. And the thing about CRPS is that you have really good days and you have really bad days. Mm-hmm. And I was on crutches and I wanted to go outside and play in the snow. I didn't have like a cast or anything like that. So I decided I was going to try and play out in the snow with my friends. And that's what I did. And then I paid for it by not sleeping that night, screaming in pain. My poor parents, my poor sister, I paid for it. And then neighborhood kids again said, oh, well, she doesn't need the crutches she has today on Monday because she didn't need them on Saturday. Mm. Never mind the fact that I couldn't get out of bed on Sunday.
And so they thought you were like faking it?
Yes. Because yeah, I had kids. Fun on Saturday. Then in fifth grade, oh, and also that year, right around the same time, there was a snowstorm and we got out of school early and my teacher offered to take my crutches and carry them to the bus because I didn't need them. And it would be much easier for me to carry things if she took the crutches.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, that's really heartbreaking.
I will name and shame. In fifth grade, there was a girl who kicked me under the table and she actually put me in a wheelchair.
Oh my gosh. Jesus. So.
I've been really struck by the way in which you've shared that in an invisible illness, people do this all the time where they kind of think that you're faking, or you've talked about like getting out of your car and getting your wheelchair out of the trunk and people like you stink
eye. Oh my God.
Oh, that's so interesting.
And I'm curious to know from your vantage point, why is it that you think people are so threatened by sort of your illness not presenting consistently, or why it's such like why they what it is that they think you're getting away with. I mean, I guess I'm just curious to know what you think is going on that people.
It's like a projection as well. There's got to be something within them that they're also projecting.
Yeah.
Honestly, this is going to sound kind of trite, but I think it's a problem with the media. Because historically, if you think about any time you've ever seen somebody get out of a wheelchair in a movie, it's a gotcha. Mm. Somebody drops their crutches, they're fine, it's a miracle, or it's a gotcha. You know, there's some crazy criminal who's in a wheelchair who's trying to pull one over on somebody, and I honestly think that it's ingrained in our society that there are people who are trying to take advantage of other people. When I was doing my wheelchair fundraiser, somebody actually called, I guess, like a fraud line on me, not with like that fundraiser, but with the fact that I had raised money. They,
oh man. Apparently
they called MassHealth and I got kicked off of my normal MassHealth. Yeah, it was a whole thing.
And wasn't the reason you were fundraising to begin with because your insurance wouldn't cover the kind of wheelchair that you needed?
Yes, they would cover it if I could get it certified by a certain kind of physical therapy wheelchair group. It's kind of complicated to explain. Yeah. Basically,
wait, insurance complicated?
Right. it basically, I had to go and get fitted for a wheelchair by a certain kind of place. And because MassHealth is siloed now into various places in the state, there's nobody in my silo that could do it. So I could pay a few thousand dollars out of pocket. Sure, I'll just pull that out of my pocket to go get this, you know, bibbidi bobbidi blessing from these people. And then my insurance would automatically deny the claim, and then I could go after it and so on and so forth. But basically, there was nobody who was covered by my insurance who could do the paperwork to get it approved. So they wouldn't approve it, is the gist of it. So I had to raise a lot of money. I raised a little over $7,000. And there were a lot of people who were like, why does a wheelchair cost that much? And I was like, because that's how much they cost.
Yeah. So bringing it back to spirituality then.
Yes.
I think one of my biggest questions before even jumping on this call was just a curiosity about if spirituality informs the chronic illness, your chronic illness, or is it even the other way around? Maybe your chronic illness informs your spiritual practice and beliefs, and what the, if there's a connection there.
Oh, I would say it's a circle of that feeds into itself. When I was really young, I had to make a decision about, am I going to be really angry that this has happened to me? Or am I just going to be a person who has this happening and find ways to live a fulfilling life? And I don't think that I specifically put it into those thoughts when I was a small child. But I do remember people saying, you're so strong, you're so brave, you're so happy, you're all these things. And it would either be, that's a wonderful thing, or it's, you're lying. You can't have those things because you're all those things. And I just remember thinking, well, why should I be grumpy all the time? People who are grumpy all the time don't seem very happy just by definition.
Such beautiful child logic.
Yeah. And I was just like, I don't know, rabbits are still wonderful and I can still look at snow and there's still a lot of joy to be had. So why should I be miserable? I mean, that's not to say I've always been very happy, because I certainly haven't been. And it's very difficult to be up all night and feel a little bit hopeless, or a lot of it hopeless. It's very difficult to not be able to keep a job because you have to take so much sick time. It's difficult to be in a relationship with someone and not feel like a burden on them. And I think that because of all of that, I've had to do a lot of work in deciding what my value is. And when I did that, I also had to think about what the value is that other people offer. And then since I just believe that we all are connected, because that's been my experience, it all kind of brings it together for me. But definitely, I would say that my belief that we are all connected and the things that we do impact each other comes a lot from my experiences as somebody who is chronically ill and doesn't look like it. When you're in that position, you hear a lot of things and you see a lot of things that other people don't notice. For example, you know, if somebody doesn't know that you're severely ill and you see, and they say some sort of comment about somebody parking in a handicapped spot and then just hopping out of the car and walking in, and they're like, oh, that must be somebody else's placard. My response to that is, why is that your first assumption? Oh, well, they could walk. I'm like, okay, but how far do they have to walk? How much do they have to think about it? If I walk into a store, which honestly, at this point in my life, I really can't, walk into a store and feel safe without my cane, because I worry that I will fall, or I use a wheelchair usually when I go to a store. But prior to getting the cane and the wheelchair, there was a long period of time as an adult where I would literally be like, okay, I know that I can walk into this store and I know that I have enough spoons or energy or whatever you want to call it to go all the way to get my hair care stuff and then get back to my car and still be able to do what I have to do to get into my house and all that. But I definitely can't go get hair care stuff and try on clothes. because that's a lot of extra steps. That requires a lot of extra mobility. So then I have to make a decision. Do I look for a shirt that I need, or do I just get shampoo and conditioner? Or do I order the shampoo and conditioner online for in-store pickup and then shop around for my shirt and then swing over to the customer service desk? And then will there be a line at the customer service desk that I have to stand in? Will I have enough in me to stand in line? And so on and so forth. So all of these things are things that disabled people or people with difficulties have going through their head just to get out of the car. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they hopped right out of the car and ran into the store, but you don't know how much prep has gone into that. And you don't know if they're going to be able to do anything when they get home. So I don't even remember what the original question was.
I don't even know if I remember. Yeah, I don't remember what my question was.
How spirituality informs your relationship with
CRPS.
So something that I, like a mantra of mine, if you will, is that I will celebrate the things that I am able to do, and I will forgive myself for the things that are out of reach. Sometimes that's literally, you know, yeah. can I physically do something? Sometimes it's a spiritual thing. Like, can I emotionally handle something? And so I try to give myself grace. And I encourage other people to do the same. I think that it's easy to fall into the trap of saying mean things to yourself and saying you're not good enough. And
that was actually something I wanted to come back to. In the very beginning, you talked about how you start all of your classes talking about this notion of ahimsa. And in particular, talking about turning it inward. And I know this is a lot of that. This is a lot of the work Eva does in her coaching is about like the way in which we, the self-love that we have. And I guess I'm curious to know if you could speak a little bit about what was the turning point for you in realizing that you were not practicing ahimsa towards yourself? What are the tools that you use to bring yourself back? Because I'm sure you're human, so sometimes you're an asshole to yourself, right? Because we all
are. Last time I checked.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. I would say it's a lesson that I've had to relearn over and over and over again. And then it just kind of settled into me and became part of me. Having people be cruel to me for a long time, I internalized that as something I deserved. That, you know, my ex-husband used to say things like, nobody will ever want you. Nobody else will ever put up with you. And that was really referring to my illness, which is very much myself. To put up with that is a lot. And it is. I mean, honestly, it is a lot to be with someone and to spend your life with someone who is chronically not good, not well. I mean, that's, you know, I give my partner a lot of credit because he's one of the most kind people I've ever known in my life, to be honest. And he does not make me feel undeserving. And I think I would honestly credit him in a lot of ways just because he loves me and accepts me as I am. And I'm not saying that I don't drive him nuts sometimes, because I know that I do. And I've gotten to the point now that I know that the things that happen with my health and the challenges that presents to us financially, and in terms of our ability to do things and have time and all these things, I know that that's a big challenge for him and it's hard for him, but I no longer worry that it's judged, if that makes sense. And so I would say really within about the past year, about a year ago was when I had the last group of people that kind of turned on me. And I just said, you know what? I'm not going to let these things that other people say about me inform my opinions of myself anymore. And when I have these mean thoughts about myself, I'm just going to start telling myself to stop it. And it wasn't a process that was automatic. It wasn't a process that was simple, or I guess it was simple, but it certainly wasn't easy. And it's not always easy now. I still have thoughts of that sort of thing, but it's like anything else. If you practice, it's almost like I learned to set boundaries with myself. Like, I will not allow myself to talk to myself that way.
Oh, yeah. I love that.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. So I guess to draw that out even more, do you feel like there are practical, I don't even know what I call them, like tools, action steps?
Sure. I mean, actively thinking about it, I definitely have, when I really started to kind of get into this mindset, I would ask people I trust, am I this? Like, I can remember going up to my partner and like tears in my eyes, wobbly voice, saying, am I a burden? Because that's my biggest fear, is to be a burden and to be kept around because somebody else feels guilty about not keeping me around. And to hear someone say, no, I don't think that way about you. Okay, well, if the person that I'm most concerned about doesn't feel that way, then I need to stop telling myself that I am to this person. If I trust this person to be honest with me, then who the hell am I to contradict them? These are the stories we tell ourselves. Why? Why am I telling myself this story? Where does that come from?
And also the bravery required in saying that question out loud, right? Like, because you are giving your partner an opportunity to really disappoint you, and you're trusting in that moment that he's gonna see you and meet you, right? Like, by asking the question, in some way you already know, it means you somewhat know the answer, right? Or are just being really freaking brave because you're opening yourself.
Yeah, because it's incredibly vulnerable.
Yeah.
because the risk that we take is, what if we get the answer that I don't want?
Ugh. Yeah, yeah.
Well, if you get the answer you don't want, then the world falls apart for a little while and you have to figure it out. I mean, I've had the world fall apart a few times and I haven't died yet.
You've always figured it out.
Yeah. And I mean, doesn't mean I want to figure it out. Doesn't mean I'm excited about it.
Right.
But I've just kind of learned about myself that I have a real deep capacity for figuring it out. And also, I'm someone that needs to understand. Maybe that's the empath in me. I don't know. But I'm somebody that I need to know if I'm making something up in my mind. And honestly, from being in an emotionally and psychologically abusive relationship for almost a decade, I came out of that relationship not knowing if I knew.
Yeah, right. From like being able to tell black from white. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I was gaslighted constantly. Like, you're making that up. I didn't say that. I'm like, what? It's in an email. I didn't send it. What? Like, you were just talking about what's in it. You know what I mean? When I left that relationship, my ability to tell what was real and what wasn't, I was just starting to get back to that.
Yeah. So it sounds like people in a community that you can really support and that you can trust is really helpful.
Oh yeah. It's vital. And it's so hard to continually put yourself out there when you've been so disappointed by people in the past. And I think it's easy when you've been so thoroughly disappointed in humanity on multiple occasions to want to build those walls. But in my personal experience, when I've built walls is when I've felt the most lonely. And when I've when I've been brave and I've tried to connect and I've asked difficult questions of people, even when I've been disappointed, I feel more connected. Even when the answer that I'm given is one that is painful and it requires me to make changes in relationships, let go of relationships, or make changes in myself. There's something in that that is absolutely remarkable, where you can come out the other side and you can say, that was a real moment. And who am I now after having that conversation? How does that conversation change how I feel about that person, how I feel about myself? And to be able to take that and kind of carry it with you and allow it to inform how you interact with other people and the choices that you make for who you're vulnerable with, that in itself is almost a spiritual experience for me.
Well, I think it sounds like,
The thing that I keep thinking about is what you're talking about is being real and authentically in the moment, and that there are so many ways in which we can sort of go around presenting different masks to each other. And what I keep thinking about as you're talking and as you're telling pieces of your story is how having CRPS and other experiences, more than a lot of people I know, you just have to live without the mask on. Like, whether you're, and like in some ways life keeps ripping it off, but also you're just like, okay, tossing that to the side, like, here's the real Anna over and over again. And
I stopped seeing the point of hiding it, because if I hide my authentic Anna self, then invariably I get to a point with somebody where they think that the fact that I've hidden it is a problem for whatever reason. The fact that I've brought it up now means I'm lying about it, or the fact that I hid it means that I was dishonest or whatever. And I'm certainly not suggesting that everybody needs to walk around talking about their health stuff or their emotional health stuff. Like, you're not required to share anything with anybody that you're not comfortable with. Mm-hmm. But I have found that people will tell you who they are pretty quickly if you're honest about who you are.
It's like, it's a process that helps you get to the truth of things. It seems like very quickly.
Yeah, and absolutely.
And if spirituality is sort of, as you centered it for us in the beginning, sort of fundamentally about relationships, the quicker you're actually being authentic and honest in that moment with that other human, even if that other human is just ourselves, that is inherently going to be closer to a spiritual experience than if we're, you know.
Damn, Kylie, I love that coming full circle, bringing it all the way back to the front. Yeah, that's so true.
Yeah.
I no longer see the point. I mean, maybe it's because I'm 35 and I've lived a long life and, you know. But let's say I understand why folks in their 80s and 90s drop pretense. And I've decided I don't need to wait until I'm 90 to drop pretense.
Oh my God. I love that so much. Yes. I just think that's so beautiful. It's like, I've talked to Kylie before about what I call alchemy, which is like turning shit into gold, which is like, you take something really shitty and difficult. And I mean, it doesn't even have to do with anything with character, but if for some reason we're blessed with some kind of wisdom to be able to turn like the hardest things into something good, then I think that's like a blessing. And that's all. No one has to do that. Like, no, I'm not saying everyone has to turn their shit into gold, because sometimes whatever, it's hard. But if we can, like, that's the most beautiful thing that we could possibly do.
Do you think by any chance that wisdom is in and of itself a communion between spirits?
Ooh, that is a big question. I love that question. I feel like that could be a whole podcast episode in itself.
Yeah. That's something I think about a lot. It's about where wisdom comes from.
Oh my God. I think about this all the time, all the time, because no one has what the fuck is an idea? No one knows what that is. My short answer is, I would say, I think it has something to do with the universal consciousness, and that it's already there all the time. Either we're tapping into it, or we're tapping into something in ourselves that's always something there. But ultimately, also, I like don't know what I'm talking about, because literally nobody has any clue where an idea comes from. It's like, you know, a light bulb that goes off and you don't know where that comes from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And why do they always appear when we're doing mindless work, like washing our hair?
Right. It's because that's when we're tapped in, because we're not we're like more open and we're not busy thinking about other things that are occupying our mental real estate.
Just really quickly, that reminds me of, I posted on Instagram yesterday, I don't know when this will come out, but I posted about an experience I had getting a tattoo recently. And how
I wanted to bring this up. Yes. Yes. Okay. Speaking of universal consciousness, go.
Basically the idea was that people get a tattoo. They say to the tattoo artist, I could fall asleep right now. And the tattoo artist is like, no, you can't, because you're getting tattooed. And that's wild. But he'd had a conversation with the studio owner that he shared with me, which was basically, they kind of came to the conclusion together that because of the pain and the mindful breathing that's involved with getting a tattoo, you're automatically in the moment in a way that most people aren't on a day-to-day basis, for all kinds of reasons. And so we kind of had this conversation about accidental meditation, and you know, is getting a tattoo, does it put people into a meditative state without them realizing it? And that probably that's what's happened, and that is the feeling, those are the words of I could fall asleep right now, those are the words that they're putting to the feeling, which is actually I'm meditating right now. And man, I've been thinking about it for 2 weeks. And it's just been rolling through my brain. And I'm thinking about all the different ways that, like you're saying, we're keyed in and how we get into these headspaces without actively trying to go there. And, you know, I was on Instagram, I had a brief exchange with this gal, Carol, that I grew up with, and about how, you know, I don't know, just the idea that we're kind of falling into these meditative states all the time without knowing mm-hmm. about it, and then trying to consciously think about not consciously thinking.
Right. We're all trying to meditate so that we cannot be thinking and like, yeah, making this big effort to do it. Yeah.
And so, you know, is the key really
be mindful,
just...
Gordy, go. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's, you know, is the key really just that you find a way to just exist without forcing yourself to be. Wow.
Well, I think really it's like how can we be in the present moment and just be? But I think because that's so hard for so many of us, myself like 100% included, that's why I have my practices. It's because if I don't like make time for it, I will so easily not be in the present moment, because I will probably always be planning or thinking about like, you know, some other thing that has nothing to do. Unless, and that's why things like yoga and dance and art and music and, you know, whatever our passion is can be so helpful, because they draw us into the present moment.
Yeah. And I think even unhealthy habits can bring us into that space. Like the example that I've thought about a lot is people who smoke cigarettes.
Right.
Because you know, people were stressed out and they're like, I have to smoke. I've never experienced that, but I think I understand the need to find a way to center yourself. Mm-hmm. I think that that's really what people are saying when they're like, I'm overwhelmed, I need to have a cigarette. They're really saying, I need to take a break to center myself. Mm-hmm. And I'm inhaling deeply and just being in my own body.
There's actually this exercise that I do with my clients, and something that I'll probably say you'll hear me say many times on this podcast, and something that I'm constantly reminding myself and other people love, is that we actually do always have this internal wisdom. Like that, what you were asking earlier, this idea about like, where do ideas come from? Or, you know, like where does clarity come from? And I think I really do believe that we always have the answer within us. Like it's already there. If it's not maybe the big answer, it's just the answer, the immediate answer that we need to take the next step. And it's always there. We just have to listen. Like, can we like slow down enough to like hear it and listen to it? And I think that's so much also of like kind of what you're talking about, which is connecting into that. So that's also another way I think of when I say connecting to universal consciousness. Like when you're listening, that's kind of what your gut or your intuition, like I think those words are interchangeable. They're all kind of related or similar or the same thing. Yeah.
So I love all of this. And I think what was interesting to me when I read what you had to say about thinking about like getting a tattoo as a way of sort of bringing you present, I was also thinking about the way that pain acts to bring us present, and particularly wanted to ask you about that, right? Because you know more about pain than anyone I know. And so when I was, I have two kids, for those of you who are listening, 2.5-year-old and a 6-month-old. And when I, my son had an epidural, was the best decision ever, would have had to have C-section otherwise. For my daughter, I decided I wanted to like forego medication. And so I thought a lot and meditated a lot about like with the relationship to pain and blah, blah, blah. I'm just setting this up so I can throw it to you. But one of the things that I thought about a lot about pain and then definitely experienced is that the ways in which our reaction to pain, physical, but I also think emotional, is to make ourselves smaller and retreat and close up
and tense
tighten
up,
yeah, right, as a protection. And so when I was thinking about it in relationship to childbirth, where you're like literally the pain is a mechanism of opening,
right?
that the more we, the more it's like the more I tense up in relationship to pain, like the longer this shit is going to take. Right. And I guess and what I found again in this particular moment is when I allowed myself to ride the wave of each of the pain and allow myself to open it, it still hurt like hell, but it was, right, there was something gentler there when I was able, mm-hmm, to be open instead of close up. And so I guess I'm wondering if any of this resonates with your relationship to pain. And I'd also say, and all of that felt incredibly sacred and made me think about, mm-hmm, how emotionally we do the same thing in response to pain and how transformation, mm-hmm, happens when we are open versus close up to emotional pain. So I don't know I guess I'm just curious, does this resonate with your experience? Does this sound like a lot of bunk? Like, you know, because my pain was 4 hours long and then I had a daughter, yours is
first
like...
of all, I'm going to say something here. First of all, I need everybody in the whole world to start thinking about this, in that no one's pain takes away from anybody else's pain. Your experience is your experience. The fact that I live with severe intractable pain every moment of my life does not mean that those 4 hours were not awfully difficult. Mm-hmm. And it does not mean that your experience was not so real and so valid. A lot of times people will say, well, I know this isn't anything like what you go through, but this is my experience. And my first instinct is to say, whoa, 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 whoa. No, mm-hmm, your experience, yeah, is your experience.
Oh, I love that. That's so, yeah, beautiful. Yeah.
So
I'm just over here silently crying. Keep going.
Oh, I love your heart. So that's just something I want to make very clear.
It's a really, really important point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You never need to apologize to me for going through a thing, because your pain is your pain. Your struggle is your struggle.
Wouldn't the world be so beautiful if we all went through it remembering this equally? Oh, I'm just like,
I wish. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just such a beautiful reminder though. Like, it's all important, mm-hmm, and none of us have to make ourselves small or big. No. Yeah. Anyway.
And then we don't have to give people stink eye when their illness is invisible, right? Because isn't that actually that some of that threat must be about thinking like they're taking away from my pain. I need my pain to be, mm-hmm, bigger. Yeah. This person.
Yep.
Yeah.
Or they're taking away from my grandmother's pain. Or I know somebody who lost a leg, and you know, whatever it is, there is something that's being threatened there. But more specifically, speaking to your experience, I do see a lot of truth in that very simply and specifically, if I am in the worst pain, I will tense up my whole body, tense up my jaw, tense up all the muscles in my scalp. If I do that, I get muscle aches. If I do it long enough, I trigger a migraine. So I've created more pain for myself simply by not allowing myself to be in pain. And I mean, a lot of that is I can't really control it, but I have learned that if I can Sorry, I'm getting cat fur in my mouth. So I've just found that in the moment, if I can try to forgive my body for putting me through what it's putting me through, and I can offer grace to my neurological systems, it doesn't change the amount of pain that I'm in, but it takes away the anger. And it doesn't take away the sadness. It doesn't make being awake at 4 a.m. and feeling like the world is crashing in any less real. But I'm not adding a level of self-deprecation and meanness to it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like I said earlier, I have to live with myself my whole life, so I should really like who I'm talking to. And I certainly shouldn't spend time with somebody who's mean to me. Mm-hmm. And so I've just kind of really recently, in the last probably 6 months or so, to be honest, I've really started to try and say to myself, this is awful, but I don't need to make it worse.
Yeah. I think it's a level of acceptance, or just to what is, but I actually wrote this down in my notes, 'cause I think it's such a beautiful metaphor for life. It's like, I think clenching and harshness creates more pain. If you're in pain, that's true of like your experience. And then it's also true of and Kylie, your experience too. And then of life, this is the metaphor of life. Shit's gonna happen. Mm-hmm. It's gonna hurt. Life is hard, but the more we clench and the more harsh we are, it just makes it worse. So it's a continual process of how can we have include softness and, like you said, grace and compassion and acceptance and all the, you know, the loving, the nice soft things.
Yeah.
That make it.
Yeah. I think that we're never more cruel than we are to ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that's just a sad truth that I've discovered in talking to a lot of people. And I'm kind of on a personal mission to help people stop doing that.
Yeah.
Including myself. And I mean, you start with the man in the mirror, right?
You know? Yeah. So I think that takes us to, cool, Kylie, because I'm noticing the time. Because it's just been such a wonderful free flow.
Yes. This is this has just been beautiful. Was there a question that you wanted to ask, Eva?
Well, I think it's a culmination of the things that we've talked about, which is that, well, one, I just have to say, I am so appreciative of you coming onto our podcast and sharing your experience, because I feel like I've learned a lot, and there are probably so many people out there who can relate to your experience and may not have a platform to share. I just think it's invaluable. Your experience is invaluable, and that's so many people want to be seen and heard. And I think you're sharing the experience of many people who may not feel seen and heard.
I hope so. And I hope that they're able to, anybody who doesn't feel like they're seen or doesn't feel heard, I hope that they can find a supportive ear and in some small way, find someone in their life, whether it's physical or digital, that they can connect with. Being able to speak with other people who have the condition that I have through Instagram. Mm-hmm. I didn't know anybody who had it my entire life.
I think I looked it up and I was actually shocked. I don't know if this is right, but they were saying only 200,000 people in the US. I don't know if you know the numbers.
It's pretty rare. I don't know the numbers, and it's always changing, but it is pretty rare.
And that just blew my mind, because I'm like, well, then holy fuck, that just makes it even harder.
And I mean, I was very lucky in that I was diagnosed fairly quickly in the 90s when literally nobody knew about it. Mm-hmm. As an adult, I've had issues with doctors who didn't believe that I even had it, because they're like, that's not possible, you can walk. And I'm like, yeah, you and everybody else, whatever, find another doctor. Mm-hmm. Like I was saying, I've had to learn how to create those boundaries. But my hope is that people will take advantage of things like social media, and search hashtags for the conditions they have, and just see if you can find one other person who's dealing with the same symptom as you, and just know that you're not alone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, which kind of goes to my question. you know, which was going to be some version of if you could give advice to people who are also suffering, or if you could give advice to your younger self, what do you think it is that you would say? Any like tips, or is there something that you wish you had heard when you were really in the thick of it?
You know, there is one thing that I wish somebody had told me, and that is that it's okay not to have a full-time job. It's okay to not be well enough to work full-time.
Yeah. Oh, that's so interesting, right? Because of so much of the, oh my God, I can only imagine there's like social pressure and then also the pressure you've put on yourself because.
And also capitalism.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, it may not be okay financially, but it's okay. You know what I mean? I made a lot of decisions throughout my 20s and the first half of my 30s based on the idea that I had to make enough money to be worth existing in this economy and in this world. And it was a lot of self-work for me to come to the conclusion that I still have something to offer, even if I'm not bringing home thousands of dollars every week, that I am still valuable to this household, that I still am a worthwhile contributor to society. And God damn it, if somebody had just told me that earlier, I don't even know if I would have heard it. I don't even know if I could have internalized it. But if somebody had said it, I think that it would have just put a little spark of an idea. And it might have made it easier to come to the conclusion without being quite so mean to myself along the way, to be honest.
Oh my God, that's so good though. It's so good because it's valuable to hear on so many levels for people who are not able to have full-time jobs, but also for anybody, I think, who over-identifies with their job and finds, a lot of people in the Western world.
Well, I mean, what's the first question that people ask? What do you do?
Exactly. Yeah.
Even now, when people ask me that question, I'm like, what do I do? I don't know. I talk to people.
Yeah. You live. You live. Like the answer should be, I'm a human being. I'm alive.
I play with my dog. I play with my cat. Like, what do I do for work? Well, in the mornings, I'm an assistant to a real estate agent. In the afternoon, sometimes I teach yoga. On the weekend, sometimes I teach yoga. And in between there, I do a lot of other things that have nothing to do with how I make money, but they're very much how I
know.
For those who can't see, there's a cat walking across behind me
into the sunlight. It's so beautiful. That's so important. Kylie, go ahead.
I'm just struck by, I think there's so many themes in this conversation that are just really beautiful and I'm so grateful for, but one of them that you've said many, many times in different words is basically like that your spiritual journey has been learning and learning again that you have inherent value. And I feel like that is true for me. And I know that that is true for so many other people, that you were just like unlearning all these stories we've told ourselves that our value is conditional upon bringing money, being, you know, productive, being, you know, whatever the things are. And I just think that that is.
They're the values that other people put upon us. They're not the values that we create usually on our own. And it's things that we learn from how other people are treated. And I think that we internalize those messages. Depending on your own mental health and any number of other things, it can be very common to take those thoughts and turn them into weapons against ourselves. And I just think that that ultimately is a waste of time and energy. It doesn't make it easy to stop, but having found that recognition, it has become easier over time to practice. And I mean, ultimately, isn't life just the practice of living? It's we're collecting all these moments, you know.
I think it's going back to those moments where we can just be. It's that how we're feeling when we're smoking that cigarette, when we're getting that tattoo, when we're playing with our cats. And
we're at that concert,
having breakfast with our kids. You know, it's those, it's like, I would even say it's not even what we do. It's just like how we be. I don't know if that's yeah. a, I don't know if that's correct grammar, but you know, like that's,
we
anyway,
just are.
Yeah. Woo! Well, I think that's a beautiful, beautiful place to sort of cap off this talk. I'm gonna just jump in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much. We wanted to ask if there's anything that you want to promote and plug. I know that you are also a creative soul, a creative being, and where can people find you?
Yeah, so primarily the easiest place to find me is through Instagram. Mm-hmm. My handle there is Anna Banana, which is what my sister used to call me when I was little. So it's like Anna Banana, but you replace the second and third A's with ER. So A-N-N-E-R-B-A-N-A-N-E-R. So actually second and fourth.
Whatever. For okay. those of you without pen and paper, we will put in the show notes.
Yes. Yeah. And through there, I have a link tree where you can, you know, see my Etsy shop. And I do a lot of custom orders for stickers and artwork and things. I'm always putting stuff up there. And
which is beautiful. I love your stuff.
Well, thank you. It's I think it's important for everyone to have a creative outlet. And for whatever reason, my creative outlet has turned into a thing where people like to buy it. So I will continue to make and sell things as long as people want to buy them. And if people stop buying things, I will just keep making things.
Amazing. Okay, so we got Instagram, Etsy, and also what about for anybody who's local, who might be listening, what your yoga classes, where can people find your yoga
so
classes?
I teach at Open Doors Yoga Studio in Taunton, Massachusetts. I teach a $5 community class, which it says on paper that it's level 2 and 3, but it's really all levels. I don't care if you don't even have a yoga mat, if you couldn't tell a yoga mat from a bath mat, it's fine. Come on in. You know, it's 6 o'clock on Friday nights. Hopefully there are no stalkers listening, but well, you can find me there on Fridays, generally speaking. And honestly, just in general, I can't say enough about the wonderful Open Doors community and the owners, Marilva and Mike, of this particular studio, because they've welcomed me with open arms and they don't see any limits in me. They see the fact that I use a wheelchair and that I use a cane as something that I bring to the studio, not something to hide or be embarrassed about. And they truly celebrate my abilities and me as a whole, yeah. as a person. And they're like that with everyone. And as somebody who is disabled and has often felt that they need to hide the truth of themselves, being fully and wholly welcomed as an individual Anna, as an autonomous Anna, is it's remarkable. And I do appreciate them. So yeah, I recommend it.
That's amazing. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know. I don't do yoga all the time, but I'm always like, yes, like more yoga studios should just have all people of all yes. types of regard. Yeah. All of it.
I want all the diversity. I want everything. You know, I actually took a class this year, training specifically for accessible yoga, which incidentally, if you look up the Accessible Yoga Foundation, they're based out of San Diego. Giovanni is a man who started that. He's absolutely fascinating. He just put out a book. It's coming out tomorrow, actually.
Oh, well, we'll put that in the show notes too, the website. Yeah.
Accessible Yoga. Excellent organization. They've taught me a lot.
Great. Awesome.
All right. I think we could keep talking, like, I feel like, for hours, but at some point we'll have to pause and we'll just reconvene. We'll have you on again.
Yes. Oh my gosh, I love that. I will come and talk to you anytime. Honestly, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing your story and your wisdom with us, Anna.
You're so welcome.
Thank you, everybody. Goodbye.
Bye. Okay.